Blog Talk.
Hour-long show dedicated exclusively to both the working and aspiring screenwriter. I'm Chris Wainer, your host, along with Devin Watson.
Hi,
every
how you
week
doing?
We'll be discussing. Hey, Devin, how you doing, man? Hey, this week it worked.
Yeah.
Right away. those 12 of you who were listening last week, you got a fun 10 minutes. But anyways, every week Devin and I will be discussing screenwriting, movies, sometimes Hollywood. Every week we'll have a special guest. We'll debate weekly screenwriting topics of interest to you, the writer. And finally, feel free to call in. Our call-in number is 646-716-5193. That's 646-716-5193. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to take you back in time. They called it Narratage. First, the Fox Publicity Department, and then New York Times movie critic Mardont Hall. They were speaking of Preston Sturges' groundbreaking screenplay, The Power and the Glory, which was released as a motion picture in 1933. It is neither a silent film nor a talking film, Sturges explained, but rather a combination. It embodies the action of a silent picture, the reality of voice, and the storytelling economy and richness of characterization of a novel. The Power and the Glory is a landmark screenplay for several reasons. First, it was written on spec as opposed to the common practice of the time of the writer being assigned a story, which was a big deal back then. You were assigned stories. Secondly, when Jesse L. Lasky of Fox Studios purchased the script from Sturges, he agreed to pay him a percentage of the gross of the movie, something unheard of at the time. Lasky's acceptance of the terms that Sturges wanted were not surprising when you consider that he believed it to be the most perfect script he had ever seen. This, of course, caused an immediate uproar within the industry. Sturges' power and his influence on that film was unprecedented. Third, Sturges was also on set. He was allowed to be on set, another almost unheard-of thing at the time. He worked side-by-side with director William K. Howard as his dialogue director. And fourth, and finally, and perhaps most impressively, at a time when screenplays were worked on by upwards of a dozen different writers, Lasky ordered that no one touch Sturges' screenplay. They filmed it as is. And even most importantly, Sturges' screenplay was a cinematic revelation at a time when Hollywood movies were criticized for being talky and stagnant. They were struggling with this new medium of sound and action. As you recall before, this time period we had silent films, and as they moved into talking pictures, they hit this, you could say, bump in the road in terms of how to write stories for the screen. The Power and Glory told the dark and tragic story of the rise and fall of a railroad tycoon, Tom Garner, whose suicide sets the stage for the film. The story opens with his funeral and then shifts through time, moving back and forth according to Sturges' unique narrative vision. The narrator is Tom's boyhood friend and business partner Henry, whose narrative helps to tie all the story's leaps and bounds together. This style of storytelling convinced some critics and skeptics alike that film could recapture its cinematic artistry, and indeed it did. So today, are there signs of such artistry in film? I don't know, but I hope so. And I hope that we can hearken back to true writers like Preston Sturges and so many others that I think we're missing today in the world of film and certainly the world of screenwriting. Thank you. Devin, so how are you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing great.
Did you get any writing done this week? Have you had a chance to hit the keys at all?
Oh, quite a bit, actually. Burning the candle at both ends, that's what it feels like.
Those of you who didn't join us last week, Devin, if you've been to ScreenArtsUtopia.com, he's got his first film coming out this year. We of course affectionately know it by its different name, but Devin, why don't you give us a little update on how your movie's going? It's in the final stages of its special effects, isn't it?
Right. We've got about 40 effects shots left to do by March, thereabouts. And after that, it gets released. We have a full orchestral score done, and just got to get the everything laid back with the audio and put the effect shots in, and there it is.
Yeah, Devin's movie is called The Curse. It's a horror film, and I think it's a different kind of horror film. It's got a great screenplay. I had a chance to read it, and it should be out sometime, hopefully this spring or summer, and we'll look forward to that. I want to give a quick plug to our show sponsors. Co-write, a truly innovative screenwriting contest in association with Bender Spink. Check them out at www.cowrite.com. Also, Final Draft, use what the professionals use, Final Draft. That's www.finaldraft.com. In a minute, I'm going to bring on Todd, who's a part of cowrite.com. He's going to give us a little background information on Co-write, and looking forward to that. Before we do that, Devin, though, I wanted to get into some of the news stories we didn't get a chance to talk about last week. The WGA Screenwriting Awards announced their nominees. I guess the Coen brothers and Woody Allen were among the nominees. I think it was last Wednesday or the Wednesday before. I forget what it was. But this is a pretty big deal. What did you think of some of their nominees?
Well, I like the Coen brothers. Usually Coen brothers come up with something that's always really unique. You know when you're going to see one of their movies just because it's just so off the wall in terms of what they actually put into it. You know, you have all kinds of interesting characters that are really quirky. For Woody Allen, I'm actually glad to see he's still around. His early work.
He's still alive and kicking, I guess.
Yeah, and his early work I'm really much a fan of, and it was his later work. I mean, I think he really came back with Deconstructing Harry. And from then on, a lot of his stuff was Mighty Aphrodite. That was great, too. Certainly one of the icons of the field in terms of what he does. He doesn't just write it. He directs it. He pretty much has full control of his projects.
Do you think he's relevant today, though? I mean, I don't know. He doesn't write the kind of stories that seem to be big today. You know, he has characters who actually, you know, are fully developed and well fleshed out. And today I just bemoan the fact that we got so many writers who substitute attitude for characters, and it's kind of sad. But then again, I look at the nominees here, and they're all, I think, some great writing. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button by Eric Roth. I mean, for the story, of course, based on F. Scott Fitzgerald, about a man who ages in reverse. The Dark Knight, of course, Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan, and based on a story by David S. Goyer. I thought that was some excellent writing for, a comic book character. Though that's not surprising, because it's interesting, because Spider-Man had some great writing as well. Doubt by John Patrick Shanley, it was based on his stage play, and then of course Frost Nixon, which is by Peter Morgan and based on his stage play. Also, finally, Slumdog Millionaire by by Simon Beaufoy. I don't know if that's the way you pronounce it or not, but I wasn't watching the Golden Globes, and I guess they kind of cleaned up there, according to what I read. Slumdog Millionaire was the big winner for the Golden Globes. Did you happen to catch that at all last week?
I did see some of the results afterwards, as they were actually while they were happening on the live news feed I watch. And yeah, it was actually kind of nice to see what was basically thought of as the underdog coming out,
right,
and basically going toe to toe with some of these really big, broad, big studio projects and still holding its own. And
right,
that just proves that if it's a good story and it's captivating and compelling enough and it's told right, it doesn't matter where it comes from. People will find it. It will be sought
right
out.
Hey, Dev, I'm gonna bring in Todd real quick. Todd from Colwright. Todd, you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hey, Todd. How you doing? This is Chris and Devin. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Todd. I just wanted to have you tell us a little bit about Colwright.com and what you're doing with Bender Spink. Could you give us a little background on that?
Absolutely. Well, first off, it's ColwrightScript.com.
ColwrightScript.com. Sorry.
Right. Two words. One word, ColwrightScript.com. So the idea is to build a community-sourced screenplay. So in essence, it's a collaborative screenplay written by aspiring writers throughout the world, 10 pages at a time. So a movie premise has been posted on the website, ColwrightScript.com, and now aspiring writers, actually the deadline for the first 10 pages is midnight tonight, Eastern Standard Time, and the first 10 pages will be posted, the winning 10 pages will be posted on Monday, January 26th, and the community source screenplay will build from there. Every other week, 10 more pages will be added until the screenplay is finished and ready to be sold. At that point, there will be a grand prize winner who will get a paid rewrite. And when the script is all said and done, Bender Spink is going to take a look at it and decide what to do with it.
And as far as Bender Spink, we know who they are, but can you tell our listeners a little bit about Bender Spink? Because this is quite an opportunity for writers.
It's a great opportunity. Bender Spink is a very well-known and respected management production company. They manage some great writers. Actually, one of the aspects of the site is called the Prose Take, where professional screenwriters and industry professionals are going to comment on the developing story. So the pro that is on there right now, Andrea Berloff, is one of their clients. And they just represent a ton of great writers, and they've produced a ton of great movies, including A History of Violence.
Right.
The Ring. Chris Bender, I think, was a producer on American Pie. So they're very well respected in Hollywood.
They are. And once again, that's ColwrightScript.com. And of course, I've screwed that up, which is par for the course for me. That's ColwrightScript. And those of you who visit ScreenWriterUtopia.com, you've seen their advertisements there. And we encourage you to check them out. And the deadline's tonight.
The first deadline is tonight at midnight, but there'll be another one 2 weeks from now for the second 10 pages.
Okay.
And each winner will get a chance to speak with Bender Spink as well, in addition to winning money.
Will they get a chance to pitch their ideas, or is it just kind of an informal type chat?
They'll get a chance to pitch their script ideas and screenplays to Bender Spink.
Oh, that's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, Todd. Well, once again, since I screwed up, I'll say it again. It's ColwrightScript.com, and tonight's the first deadline at midnight. And I appreciate you taking the time to call in and give us a quick breakdown on what you're doing.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Todd. Bye. All right. Moving on, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in about 15 seconds. All right, welcome back to Screen Talk, SU Screen Talk Radio, the only weekly, hour-long show dedicated exclusively to both the working and aspiring screenwriter. I'm Chris Wainer, your host, along with Devin Watson. Every week, if you haven't been visiting us, we'll be discussing screenwriting, movies, and sometimes Hollywood itself. Every week, we'll have a special guest. We're about 10 minutes away from welcoming our special guest. We'll be talking screenwriting, and every week we'll bring on industry professionals, professional writers, and all kinds of aspects of really Hollywood and writing. Because as a writer, you cannot be pigeonholed into simply looking at what professional writers had to say. Obviously, that's great advice, it's great information, but we always have to be, like last week, Devin, we had Gene on, and he had some pretty informative things for writers.
That's right. It's good to have at least the perspective of somebody who's been in the business and has seen the other part of the process. If you're a writer that doesn't participate in the process, the rest of the process, or at least doesn't have some idea of how it all works, you might not actually learn or gain that kind of knowledge where you can actually reapply it later in all of your other scripts, which makes things go a lot more smoothly.
Right. Well, when we left before, we talked to Todd at CorewriteScript.com, we were talking about Slumdog Millionaire, and, you know, it cleaned up the Golden Globes. I didn't get a chance to watch the Golden Globes, though I really like to, because I like to see all the stars getting hammered, and that's always kind of pleasant. You know, I'm not a real big fan of sitting and watching an hour, 2 hour long award show, but that one in particular is kind of fun because they're all drinking. They got the champagne on the table and they're grabbing the bottles and you can just tell their shit face. It's kind of fun to watch. But anyway, Slumdog Millionaire really wrapped up, you know, for the most part, the major awards. It won Best Motion Picture for a Drama. Danny Boyle won for Best Director. It won for, you know, it's kind of funny, it won for Best Screenplay. And on the EW.com, EntertainmentWeekly.com website, I'm looking at right now, the only freaking award they didn't give the name of the person was Best Screenplay. It just says Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah. At that point, you just say, okay.
We know who it is. I mean, yeah. But still, it's like, okay, was there a writer or did a freaking script just, you know, develop through osmosis, you know?
It was parthenogenesis. It just spontaneously.
Yeah. It's the only freaking thing. Of all the awards for film, it's the only one. They didn't give the guy his freaking name up there. And, of course, we'll give it to him. I'm butchering his name, but it's Simon Beaufoy. It's B-E-A-U-F-O-W. How would you?
Beaufoy.
Mm-hmm. Is it French or do you think it's Louisiana Cajun?
It looks to be French to me.
French, I would say French, yeah.
I'm giving French lessons now. Beaufoy.
But anyways, the poor bastard doesn't even get his name listed on EW Entertainment Weekly's website. Did they even list him in the story? I don't even see it. But anyways, but that's typical. Screenwriters, this is a lesson. If you think you're going to write your screenplay, sell it to whoever, and yeah, you'll make some money, you know what? First screenplay, maybe you'll make $350, $500, I don't know, you get really lucky, who knows. And then you get to, maybe it gets produced, and then maybe it's like half decent, and it wins an award, and then they won't even freaking put your name on the news press release. So welcome to screenwriting Hollywood style, where they're always willing to treat screenwriters like that stuff that sticks to the bottom of your shoe when you're walking across hot pavement. Anyways, moving on, because I get real edgy and I get real, you know, Golden Globes. I don't know. Anything you want to add there, Devin? Golden Globes? Anything? Was there any hotties there? Was there any good looking? Because you,
I
heard Kate Winslet was kind of bouncing around a little bit.
Well, yeah. Well, Kate Winslet, I thought that she was going to become the Susan Lucci of the Golden Globes, as in, you know, always a bridesmaid, never a bride. But, you know, finally she wins and. I was half expecting her to curse a blue streak like a sailor up there on the podium because, you know, she's...
You know, nothing. It's kind of sexy, though, when women start cussing, especially good-looking ones, don't you think?
Well, yeah, well, with her, she's known to go blue, so to speak. And,
right.
And it's rather funny. I was actually hoping for that, you know, with the... The alcohol freely flowing there. I was expecting something like that, you know, like almost like the when Jack Nicholson got up there 1 year and just really let out. That was a really funny moment.
Well, Jack, was he there? He's still alive, still, isn't he? He's not that old.
Oh, Nicholson?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's still around.
He's still pumping. Good. But you know, hey. Final comment on the Globes. That's see that Mickey Rourke won for The Wrestler. And I think that's super cool because if there's a guy that I can't relate to more than Mickey Rourke, I don't know who it is. I just love the guy. I think it's great that he's I don't know if he's back, especially after his comments last week in the paper about not wanting to blame Bush. I mean, I know that's the wrong thing to say when you're in Hollywood, but you know, that probably killed his Oscar possibilities. I'll make a prediction right now because of Mickey Rourke's political opinionated stance last week about not wanting to hate Bush, and I don't know, he didn't really support him, but I would say that that's going to cost him that crucial vote for the Oscar. That's my prediction. Anyways, so Colin Farrell won. Heath Ledger, of course, best performance by an actor in a supporting role. Sadly, he's not with us anymore. He won. Colin Farrell, I just said that. Kate Winslet, who else? What else is interesting here? Animated feature, Wally, who cares? So.
Well, Wally, I have not seen Wally yet. I know it's a travesty, you know. Oh man, a screenwriter hasn't watched every movie under the sun. But I do know that that was actually quite popular with children and adults. And I see this as like a cycle where we get a whole bunch of these adult themed movies, and then we get some little animated ones.
Okay, here's the question: mm-hmm. Is the writing in animated feature films better than feature films?
Well, it can be tougher. It's tougher to.
No, is the writing recently been better?
There's been some really good. I think there's been some really.
Because everyone keeps telling me how animated films, adults can go with their little rugrats and they can laugh too, and I'm like, God.
Well, okay. I'm not a father. I know you are, and you've had to.
I neglect my kids. I don't even talk to them. So.
Okay. Well, going to see movies, and of course my brother, he has several of his own as well, and of course they're at Teletubby stage right now, so anything bright and shiny pretty much gets their attention.
What about writers wanting to get into animated feature film writing? Would you recommend it? I don't know.
It's a tough field because it's very limited in terms of the number of positions available to do that kind of stuff.
I wouldn't recommend it. If you think you've got a great animated feature screenplay, you know, it's winter, use it to start a fire. All right, moving on.
Oh, no. Go ahead and just give it a shot anyway. I mean, if you don't try, you'll never know.
My advice, I said it last week, I'll say it again to writers, is you're going to have to do one of two things. You're going to have to either give up or get medicated. In my choice, I decided to get medicated. Now, I mean, I don't know. I mean, give up or get medicated. And then if you're going to continue, I mean, how many of you write while you're sober? I mean, that's so old school.
Well, I'm quite sober when I write, but...
get up in the morning. You don't have a job. You just write. And that's all. You see, it doesn't count. Most you know, schmucks of Underwood's got to go to their job. Okay, they got to work that 8-9 hours, and they got to go take the long ride home in the bus or whatever, and then they got to put the kids to bed after they feed them, and then maybe it's 9-10 o'clock at night, and they finally get to sit down and write. And man, would a scotch and water or you know, rum and coke just really be the kind of the topper of the night, you know.
Well, there was a time when I actually was, not very long ago, when I was that guy who did work. And actually, I was working 12-hour shifts and then coming home and writing as well. So it was...
Okay, you're a freak. I don't know.
I know. I'm just I'm a mutant of some kind.
Okay, screenwriting debate of the week. This is the section we for about 5 minutes here. Devin and I get to debate a topic on screenwriting. Typically, what happens is Devin will make some comment, and then I'll belittle it, and then we'll argue. But anyway, so this week I decided we're going to talk about screenwriting basics, and maybe specifically outlining and organizing for writers. You know, I don't think it's a good policy for writers to just say, I can do this, and they sit down and start writing. But I might also of the opinion that you have to have everything like outlined, because you got to have that creativity in there. I mean, if you have everything so outlined that it's rigid, you know, where's the creativity? When do you let your characters take you in directions that are exciting and new and things like that? So my question to you, Devin, that I'm going to then belittle is your answer is, when do you know you're ready to start writing?
When I've got a beginning.
That's wrong. I don't agree with that.
Okay. When I've got a beginning, middle, and end, that's usually the Weisenheimer answer to the question.
Who's that?
Well, you know.
Weisenheimer.
Yeah. You know, real famous guy known for his sarcasm. Anyway.
By the way, we didn't get to your news topic again.
Oh, that's all right.
See what happens, Devin and I have this script, and we send it back and forth a week long. We email each other stuff we want to talk about, and we never get to Devin's stuff. And he's so good about it, he never says a word. We'll get to it next week, Devin, I promise.
Okay.
All right, anyways, to when do you know you're ready to start writing?
Usually when I have a seed of an idea, and I will write down keywords for start. That's usually how I start with the keywords that come to mind about the story, what I want it to be about. Then I move up to the characters themselves, and I do some sketches on that. Give a little bit of background on each one. And then I just kind of throw them into the mix and see what happens. Actually, I don't do any really hard outlining because once you get into outlining, you really can go off on these wild tangents and not stick to your story at all. And if you keep a few hard rules for your universe, for the world that you're creating, it's easier to just, it gives you plenty of wiggle room because you never know. There might be something that comes in and says, well, I really wanted to put the scene in, but, and it really would have helped the story, but all these other scenes I have, it just doesn't fit now. And
right. And that's a good point. Is I think the hardest thing for writers, and this is kind of getting a little bit off the basics, but you got to be able to kill the darlings, you know, those scenes that you just love, but, you know, like Bill Clinton would say, you know, I love that story, I love that scene. But you got to cut it, you know, it's Monica Lewinsky, you got to get her out of there. You know, it doesn't fit, it's not moving the story forward, it's not, you know, it's not exposing character, you got to get rid of it. Anyways, go ahead.
So, yeah, when I know to start is when I've got a fairly complete idea. I can see the story from beginning to end in my head. At least the highlight points that go along where my plot twists are. And it's really not that many you have to have. You can have as many as you want.
No, plot twist. You know, we're going to assume that most of us know what plot twists are. But then again, let's go ahead and give a real quick definition. Plot twist in a story. Give me a quick one-sentence description plot twist. Go.
Where you take the problem originally in the story and you up the ante and turn it around and make it even more difficult.
Wrong. A plot twist is when the story goes in a new and exciting, interesting direction that was not anticipated. Okay, go on.
Okay.
Devin, you're only the expert. I'm just the hack. I mean, you're the guy. I've only optioned screenplays and got stuff in development. You got an actual one made into a movie. So if I can't belittle you when we're on live radio, like, you know, my life's over. So
okay.
Go ahead.
So we
where were we?
I believe we're talking about, you know, plot twists and things like that. Having just a general idea of what is going on in the story and not getting too specific, unless there's something really specific you want to put in there, keeping it that loose when you're going in and actually writing it will give you the wiggle room to actually
right.
come up with all kinds of great stuff you probably never would have come up with before while you were
yeah.
busy writing your outline.
So, I mean, I think we both agree that as a writer, you know, that story is going to germinate for a while. You're going to have, you know, for me, I got to know the ending. I got to see the ending. I got to know where I'm going. I got to know my characters. I got to know everything about them that I can. And I got to know, you know, the protagonist, the antagonist, all that good stuff. But then I got to know the main beats of the story.
Yeah.
But I don't want to know too much because I want my characters to take me in different directions. As long as I know where I'm going on my arc, on that trajectory, I'll be okay, right?
Well, yeah. If having an ending in mind, or at least knowing how you want it to end generally, will help you keep the story on track and keep it from meandering all over the place. It's like point A, point B. You got to get from point A to point B, draw a line, instead
right.
of going all over the map to get to that point.
Right. Right. And if you have too rigid of an outline, I think it restricts creativity. But also, you need to have an idea. You need to have a plan. And when I say know your ending, I don't mean, you know, I got to know that this scene goes here and this and that. You got to know what, when you resolve the main conflict of the story and that end, what's the meaning of that? To me, and this doesn't always work with every story, you know, action movies and stuff like that, but when that final scene is played out, you know, themes usually expose. There's usually something there that's significant, and you have to know your ending. You got to know what your ending's accomplishing, I think, is important. All right, we're going to take a 15-second break, and we're going to bring in our special guest, and we'll be talking to you here in a second. Just a minute.
I am.
Hal, welcome. This is Hal Ackerman of the UCLA Screenwriting School, and also the author of Write Screenplays That Sell the Ackerman Way by Tall Fellow Press. Hal, welcome to the show.
Thanks. How are you?
Good. Devin, Devin and I have been very excited about having you on. You teach classes at UCLA, and you've not only that, but you've had some of your students who have been quite successful. Can you tell us a little bit about your background before we get into some Q&A?
Sure. Are we on the air now? Or?
Yeah, we're on the air right now.
We are? Oh, okay. Because I just called in, and I didn't get to talk to anybody yet. But yes, so do you want me to talk about some of the people that I have met?
Well, yeah, because you've had some great success as far as some of your
I've had about seven or eight screenplays that were written in my class actually have become films. Quite a few others have been sold. But among some of those that are noteworthy is A Walk on the Moon that Pamela Gray wrote that had Vito Morganson in it and Diane Lane. And Sasha Gervasi, Allison Anders, people who have done quite well. Nicholas Griffin, he didn't write Matchstick Men in my class, but he was one of my students and wrote Matchstick Men afterwards.
That's a great story, a great screenplay.
Oh, I love that. Nick is a great guy, too.
And you also, Scott Rosenberg?
Scott Rosenberg was one of my students some years ago, and I knew instantly that he was going to be greatly successful. Of course, he's producing Life on Mars now and wrote Beautiful Girls and some wonderful, wonderful screenplays. Scott Kozar wrote a great script called The Machinist, in addition to a couple of other horror films. Amityville Horror, the remake of that. And,
okay.
A stupendous writer and wrote a couple of things and what became Machinist in my class. So, yeah, we've had some great success. John Sweet wrote a script that became The Affair of the Necklace that Hilary Swank was in. And I'm not the only person who has had that kind of success. Several other scripts
right.
have been written in class that have become terrific films as well. So it's a very successful program.
Well, yeah, UCLA is, I mean, it's highly recommended. Of course, it's well respected, as you said, and there are excellent instructors there. And I think one of the things that I know that I'm asked and often by writers is, as far as going to school for writing. Obviously, screenwriting like film is one of those careers that you can jump into if you get lucky enough at any time. What do you say to a writer who's thinking about spending that money to go to UCLA and study screenwriting or film along with that?
Well, as you said, you can write, many people write screenplays that sell without coming to UCLA. Among the many things that you get out of a good film school at UCLA, as opposed to some other curricula that I'm somewhat aware of, our students write many scripts. They come out having written about seven or eight complete screenplays by the time they get out. So,
wow.
Yeah, exactly. And one of our guys, a guy, Dave Johnson, who's one of my students, who's got about three terrific deals going now, said that the first 12 scripts he wrote were what he calls practice scripts. So you really have to learn, you just write a lot to get all those mistakes out of your system. Again, that's something you can possibly do at home, but one of the things that a school provides is, well, two great things that a school provides besides even instruction are deadlines, which are writer's friends, and a group of seven people around the seminar table. Each of our advanced seminars has eight people in it, who are a great audience. And who give terrific instant feedback. So you have the input of your peers during the creative process. You have deadlines, whatever dubious instruction that our faculty give. Plus,
so writers have to read each other's screenplays and comment on them.
Yes, each week we workshop another part of the script. So in my class, the first couple of weeks we bring in story outlines. Then the next 6 or 7 weeks, we're on a 10-week quarter system. So a student will come in on week number one, and we're right at the beginning of our quarter now. I think this is week three. But week number one, they'll come in with their story idea. Week number 10, they have a first draft.
Oh, I see.
That's right. We drive them.
Yeah.
We do. So, you know, I mean, the script has to be the most important thing that they're working on because it is a full-time involvement. You know, we seem to get pretty good results.
What are the most common mistakes or just generally what you see that seems to be something that arises most commonly amongst your students?
Well, I'd say that the first thing is thinking they have a story when they don't have when they have just a notion for a story. What I usually ask for in the first week is for them to write a two-page kind of telling of their story, not so much an outline as just a telling of the story that includes who the protagonist is, what the circumstances are, what you know, just the main appraisal of the story. And typically, the first page and three quarters will be a very detailed description of scene one. And the last two sentences are, you know, and, you know, through a series of wacky, you know.
I got a great idea for a story.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd say that is probably the greatest mistake, thinking that they have a full story when they really just have an idea for a story. So we spend a good deal of time really working out, and I have my own, you know, each faculty person has their own way of teaching because we teach from how we learned, and I have my own way of sort of forcing all of the events of the story out, and because you can't really write the script unless you have a pretty good, fairly decent roadmap. And I was listening to what your previous guest was saying, and I agree in some number of ways.
You know, and then we were talking about kind of the basics of screenwriting, and we were kind of talking about outlining and organizing.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you encourage? Obviously, every writer is going to be different. You don't want to put them in a box. But
that's right.
When do you think a writer knows or should know that they're ready to start writing their script?
Yeah, it's a good question. There are three pretty detailed steps that they're tedious and but you know it's not easy. You know, I have the idea of going to a writer's gym, and I sometimes talk about the gymnasts that we see in the Olympics, and we watch them do their flying routines for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. But what we don't get to see is, you know, the 7 hours every day for 6 days a week for 4 years where they're in the gym. And writers have to do that too. So I get them sort of conditioned to having to do some tedious stuff to get their story out. But I have this thing that I call a snowplow. And I tell them that they have to, for at least an hour, commit to that they're writing that like their pen will not leave the will not stop moving, and they have to just keep just spewing out this happens and then this happens and then this happens and this happens, and not to censor themselves, but you know, we usually have a beginning, so there's a starting place, and we have some sort of an ending, so we know where we're leading to, and just to try to guess, it's like going to a building site and dumping out all of the things that will be the building materials. And just keeping doing that again and again and again until they can get to the end. So they have an understanding of how many... And I also have them look at existing movies and write down all the narrative events. So they understand that, you know, that every movie has like 60 or 70 different things that are going to happen, not just three things. And then I'm a huge believer in the usefulness of scene cards as opposed to an actual outline. I like the idea of scene cards because they look like bricks, and a brick is like a building block, and you can make anything like a chimney or a wall or, you know, anything out of those bricks, is, you know, depending. But they all have palpability, and they all have integrity, and they can hold weight, and that's what for me an event, a narrative event, is. And so after they've done this snow plowing thing for like a week, and they come up with all of the events, I tell them to write each. Take one scene, one event on each scene card, so they get a big pile of scene cards. And now I tell them to try to put just that pile into a linear order. And then I like to use a big table or a floor, and to lay out 11 separate columns of scene cards, with each of those columns representing the scenes that will add up to roughly 10 pages of script. So, you know, maybe if a scene averages 2 pages, you know, that each of these columns is going to have, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 scene cards in it.
Right.
And you can now just look at that structurally and see what you got. And I also tell them to use a different colored card for the bottom of each column. Like I call it the blue card scene. And that is like the turning point event. It's like setup, 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 boom, payoff. And I give several films as examples, sort of take them through it, like what would be the blue card scene in each of those, in each of those columns for a screenplay. And if you have 11 of those columns, each of which is 10 pages, there's your 110-page script. And at the end of the third column, the bottom of the third column, that would be probably the end of the first act, roughly page 28, page 30. The end of the bottom of the eighth column, that's the end of your second act. So you really have a visual representation of the story right there in front of you. You can look at each column as it leads up to the blue card and see, do I have too many or too few index cards in that? If I have, 13 cards in there, well, that's going to be more than 10 pages. So you can start making adjustments before you even start to write. And it just presents itself, for me, visually in a more effective way than an actual outline does.
I think that's a great way for especially a new writer who is starting to learn the craft.
That's right.
I mean, I think a new writer has to be a lot more organized than an experienced writer. And when
absolutely.
You just outline with the blue cards is,
absolutely.
I think, an effective strategy.
Absolutely. And also, if your story has multiple plots in it, a couple of subplots, counterplots, you can use a different colored scene card for the scenes of that of the counterplot. And again, you can just see how it is woven through the master story. Are they all congealed around one spot, and do you lose it for three columns, or is it does it keep coming back? So again, it's a visual representation right in front of you. But I say that once a writer, I say to answer your original question, when can you start writing? I think when you know absolutely the scene that's going to end your first act, and that you know absolutely the scene that's going to end your second act, and you have a couple of those, and you have each of the two blue card scenes at least for your first act, I say, okay, you can start to write your first act.
Wow, very good. I read an interview you did a few years ago, and I want to bring up a quote that I thought was interesting. And the quote is this. You said, "The wonderful and horrific truth about the film business is that many of the people who decide what gets made seem to have no ability to distinguish between truth and trash." And equally said, that is also true about audiences. Some films are written by people who probably had more aptitude as shoe salesmen. I love that quote. And then he went on to say that many bright and deserving screenplays are not recognized. How difficult is it for you to encourage writers not to give up or get medicated when it's really such a truth that it's more than talent?
Well, I think a lot of people have that understanding. We try to encourage it and really talk about, I'm from the 60s, we had our little motto about, it's not the destination, it's the journey.
Right.
But who cares about the 60s anymore except, old cockers like me. But, we bring in lots of former graduates, some of whom have made success right away, some of whom have not, some of whom not yet even made it, and allow those people to to talk about what it means to have a career and how to sustain yourself. A story that I remember, I guess fondly, was early in the career of now I'm just blanking on his name, of course, only the key element of the story. this is so embarrassing. He wrote The Big Chill, so you know who I mean. Lawrence Kasdan, thank you. He was talking about trying to get The Big Chill made. And at that point, he was not an entry-level writer. He had already written, which at the time was two of the top five grossing films of all time. And he said that in trying to get The Big Chill made, 57 people said no. And he was not a kid. He was, the most established. And then ultimately the 58th said yes, and it got made. And I think there's a great lesson there. First of all, about stamina and about believing in yourself. We really talk a lot about that and about building a network of survival, of friends, of lovers, of having another job, and of loving your craft and of recognizing that. There's very few people, there's very few proctologists that would do their job freelance. We as writers do it as an act of love, and we have to think of it that way as well. So,
go ahead, Devin.
That said, there have been a couple of suicides.
I heard something very similar to that from the stunt coordinator on last movie I worked on, which basically went something like, we definitely don't do this for the money.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Devin. I'm sorry, you weren't done.
Which, yeah, it's very true. You got to really love this if you want to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think too many writers enter into it thinking, you know, I'll write a screenplay and then I'll become, you know, famous, wealthy, whatever, when they don't realize that they might as well go buy a lotto ticket, as
that's
we
true.
Always heard the cliche.
Yeah, and of course, you know, some people win the lotto and some people sell a script right away. I mean, it happens.
Is there an inspirational story that you share if you're students about, you know, there's lots of great stories of writers
yeah.
who just kind of made it. Is there one that you happen to tell?
Yes. Fernley Phillips, who's a brilliant writer, he wrote The Number 23 that Jim Carrey was in, had come from England and was had gone first through, actually was in our, we have an adjunct program to our MFA that's called a certificate program called the Professional Writers Program, and Fernley
right,
was in
yeah.
it. He was in a couple of classes with me, and just a stupendous, stupendous writer, and just lovely, as lovely a human being as you can imagine. Was not having success, and was down to about like his last $23 and his return ticket to England, and had written this script of Number 23, and somehow he had a conversation with Brad Silberling, who was a director who had come out of our program, who told him that Fernley that Jim Carrey's favorite number was 23, and somehow the script got to him, and like a day before he was going to have to leave the country, the script was sold. So
because of Number 23.
Yes.
And that movie actually has a very special place in my life because it premiered on my birthday.
Ah, excellent.
Were you 23 when it premiered, Devin?
No.
That was beautiful.
It was February 23rd, though, and
uh-huh.
23, of course, you know, has some special meaning in my life, too, so.
Well, good, so
well,
the three of you have
good,
something in common.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Those of you who are just joining us, we're talking to Hal Ackerman, author of Write Screenplays That Sell, The Ackerman Way, and professor of UCLA. Hal, I want to ask you a few more questions. One thing I noticed,
sure.
First of all, your book, I thought, was really realistic. I mean, I hate some of these books that make it sound like anyone can sell a screenplay. I thought you presented a very even and heady approach. But I also really liked your, I think the title, the chapter was Living Your Writer's Life.
Uh-huh.
And in that you talked about, you know, kind of when you decided to take your chance and go off and be a writer. Can you kind of share a little bit with as far as the inspiration for that chapter and why you felt it was important to share with writers?
I better look at it and see what I wrote. Well,
you just talked about how you were 20 and you're in New York.
Okay. I grew up in New York, and my first love was theater, really. And I had written a bunch of plays that were on the off Broadway circuit. And then I wrote an anti-Vietnam War play, actually. And I was absolutely sure that the outrage that this dark satirical comedy would provoke among the populace would cause people to rise up and you know, and end the war instantly. And sure enough, 8 years later, the power of the pen. But there was sort of an unfortunate experience I had with a producer and director who were involved with it and wanted to steal credit and blah blah blah. Anyway, I got a little disillusioned, and some friends of mine had already come out to California and, you know, were sort of luring me out here. And so when I came, I had absolutely no knowledge of the movie industry. I had two things. I had, you know, my New York arrogance, and maybe just one thing. Maybe just that. Yeah, just the idea that if you could write a play, surely you could write a movie. And I remember writing my first, what I thought was a screenplay, and showing it to somebody actually that agreed to be an agent and read it for me. And you know, he kind of chortled and said, "Wow, terrific dialogue, terrific characters, but I can't see where your first act ends." And I remember sort of chortling to myself and thinking, "Okay, he's just razzing the new guy, because I know movies don't have acts. I mean, plays have acts. I know when a play act is over because the curtain comes down and you go out and smoke a cigarette." So I just thought he was razzing me. And then I, you know, as Stanislavski says, you know, when you think you know everything, prepare to enter the next phase of your education. And so I had to really sort of learn about what movie structure was all about and what it was. And so I just started going to see, you know, doing something I'd never done, going to see every movie that I could, and really learning a respect for the, for movie writing, which I never really had. And coming to an understanding of what structure was on my own, and you know, and it's from that really that I teach, you know, what I learned in writing that, and you know, it was humbling, but and humbling in a good way, I think.
So you were a playwright and a bartender, or
yes, exactly. waiter and a bartender.
That's an original occupation for a writer, a bartender.
Not for New York. Yeah, right, exactly.
And you still write today, don't you?
Say it again.
You still write plays and poems.
Yes, I had a play that was on this past June. It was called Testosterone: How Prostate Cancer Made a Man of Me. I had a nice run in at the Powerhouse Theater in Santa Monica, and it's going to be moving to New York at the end of this year. And I'm writing a novel as we speak also. So yes, writing is still very much a part of my life, and I write fiction and you know screenplays too. Yeah, so all of those things.
And it's a good point, I think, because especially at UCLA, where the instructors there are working writers. I mean, all of you guys have had success, and it's one thing. I mean, a lot of people say, well, why go to college to be a writer? They don't. Those guys are ones who have failed, and it's not true of UCLA. UCLA is full of excellent writers.
That's absolutely true. That is true.
So, hey, I appreciate you taking the time to visit with us, and I encourage everyone to go out and check out Hal Ackerman's book, Write Screenplays That Sell, The Ackerman Way, and also check out UCLA. It's a great school, and you have a lot of great professors like Mr. Ackerman. And Hal, I thank you again for taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye now.
Well, we're going to take a quick short break, and we'll be back with you in about 15 seconds. All right, Devin, we got about 8 minutes to go here in the show, and I know that we didn't get to Watchmen copyright. Did you want to get into that tonight, or want to do that next week?
Let's do that next week, because it's still kind of unfolding, and I'd like to see how it ends, and then we can talk about it in hindsight better. You did have the one subject of books, the recommendation.
Right, you know, kind of the theme with having Hal Ackerman on, you know, his book's only been out for a few years, so there's other books that you and I, you know, being the old farts, have kind of read. So I want to know from you, if you had to recommend two books, and of course, besides Hal Ackerman's book, because that would be a must, right? Screenplays That Sell, The Ackerman Way. Besides Hal's book, if you could only give two other books to writers that they had to read, what two would you suggest for an aspiring writer?
Well, one is The Hero's Journey by Lagos Egri, who is...
You bastard. You stole. I told you I was going to mention that book.
Actually, no. You had a different one by him.
The Art of Dramatic Writing. Okay, sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So, Hero's Journey is one I would recommend, and the other one, it's not a very well known one, but if you're getting into like you want to tackle much more heavy, dark material, I would suggest Owning Your Own Shadow by Robert A. Johnson. It's not a very long book, but it does delve into Jungian psychology, which is very informative in terms of just trying to understand the darker side of human nature.
For those of you who don't know, Devin writes, well, you know, his expertise is horror writing, and of course he has to delve into that psychobabble stuff. But what's the name of the book again? I'm going to write that down, actually. What's the name of it?
Owning Your Own Shadow by Robert A. Johnson.
What's the significance of that title? That's interesting.
Well, it has to do with Jung, who posited the idea that there is such a thing as the shadow self, which is the darker side of your emotions, thoughts, things of that nature that you can't control. They're down. They're part of you, but you really can't control them directly. But the idea is, Jung believed that if you embrace and accept the idea that you have them, that you can live at peace with your shadow self.
Wow. So those of you who might not be that sophisticated of a thinker might want to pass up on that one, but that sounds interesting. So two good books. I'm going to be more practical. I've been thinking about this since it was my question. And Linda Sager, Dr. Linda Sager, author of Making a Good Script Great, which I love, one of my first books I read, but her book Advanced Screenwriting came out a few years ago, didn't receive a lot of praise. But I really liked her book, Advanced Screenwriting, because it was talking about getting out of the box as a writer. Talked about alternative structure, kind of getting away from that linear structure of drama, though I know that it's very important that writers start off with that kind of idea for their screen stories. But she talked about, kind of writing outside the box in her book, Advanced Screenwriting. And I think it's a good thing once you become an experienced writer and you've had some writing underneath your belt and you feel comfortable getting out and exploring the possibilities of the narrative. And that's one thing that really irks me about the three-act structure. And Sid Field, who I like, is a good man. I met him many times, and his book's awesome. You got to read it. But I just think it's kind of the old school. We got to think beyond the three-act structure, because you cannot write a good motion picture movie that has a beginning and an end and characters that do something without it being three acts. There's just no way, right?
It's there. It's just.
To buy a book on three-act structure, you might as well go, and burn money in a fireplace, because it's obvious. There's no way you can't. It's when you get outside the box and when you push the envelope and you try new things as a writer, I think is important. And my second book has nothing to do with the craft of writing. It's by Max Wilk, and it's called Schmucks with Underwoods. And Devin, of course, we all know Mr. Warner, Jack Warner. Those of you ignoramuses or 20-year-olds who don't know anything about Hollywood history, Jack Warner, of course, Warner Bros. One day in a fit of rage, called his writers Schmucks with Underwoods. And actually, Max Wilk in his book has several interviews with classic Hollywood screenwriters. And to me, like I started the show off with, to me, if you're going to be a screenwriter, you're going to be serious about it, you got to know the history of screenwriting. You got to know the history of the narrative, the history of film. If you're a horror writer, you got to get Devin's book that's going to be coming out this year. You got to read. You got to know your craft, man. You got to know something about it. And I kind of want to leave the show with kind of a funny story that Max Wilk recalls in the introduction to his wonderful book, Schmucks with Underwoods: Conversations with Hollywood, with Hollywood's classic screenwriters. In there, Harry Cohn, all of you, I'm sure, know the name. He was the guy running Columbia Pictures back in the day. And there's a funny story about him when he arrived early to the Columbia Pictures studio lot. And this is back in the day when writers punched a freaking clock and had to show up on studio grounds and write. They had, like, offices and stuff. And he shows up early one day, and I'm going to pick up Max Wilk's words here. And this is what he writes. And then there's the story of the day when Harry Cohn paid one of his early morning visits to his studio. He strode into the courtyard around which rose the writer's offices, and he noticed something which disturbed him greatly. That is silence. No sound emerged from the tiers of rooms wherein Columbia Pictures scenarios were produced. Scenarios is old speak for screenplays. "Where are the writers?" Cohen announced. "Why aren't they working? I don't hear sound. I'm paying you guys big salaries and don't do anything. You're stealing my money." Suddenly, from a score of windows came the clacking of typewriters. "Liars!" brawled Cohn. We should get started pronto. Back in the day, Schmucks with Underwoods, back when you had to punch in these little typewriter keys and type up. Could you imagine how befuddled writers would be today having to write in a manner where it was permanent, that didn't have spell check, didn't have Microsoft Word? Devin, could you do it?
Probably could, but back in the day, a spell checker was a real person who walked around with a red pencil and would mark your stuff up for you.
Yeah, beautiful. I know. So remember this, writers. You don't, even those professionals, thank God the days are gone where you have to go and show up at the studio lot early in the morning, and if you're not working, meaning you're not hitting those keys, in comes the executives. Maybe we should go back to that by the quality of some of the writing I see recently. I don't know. Anyways, thanks for joining us. Join us next week for another special guest. This has been Screen Talk Radio.